Morning. Good to be here. Have an opportunity to study together. I'm going to turn to Judges chapter 11. We'll be reading from that chapter in just a moment. Judges chapter 11. The idea for this lesson kind of began a couple of weeks ago in our Sunday morning class when we were studying about the death of John the Baptist and talking about Herod and the situation there, which we'll come to in a little bit. And someone, I think, mentioned a story in the Old Testament about a person named Jephthah, who you may know or may not know, but something particular happened in the life of that man who gives reason for him to be in the Old Testament stories. And I like the Old Testament, so any opportunity I have to preach from it, I take advantage of that. And so we're going to look at several stories this morning, but we're going to begin with his story, and I invite you to read along as we go through that story in chapter 11 of Judges. And then as we draw near the end of the lesson, you'll see that this actually will eventually tie to the story of Jesus and the sacrifice for our sins that we try to think about, especially on the first day of the week. Judges chapter 11, and verses 1, 2, and 3, let's read that. Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead was the father of Jephthah, and Gilead's wife bore him sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." And so Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob, and worthless fellows gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. I imagine it would have been difficult for Jephthah, rejected by his family. But you might understand his brothers, I mean, that they would be concerned that about this older brother who, you know, whether or not he would inherit, receive the inheritance based on the fact that he was the son of a harlot. And that not the mother of the family. And so as a result of that, they drove him out. And evidently the townsfolk supported that as well. Well, in verse 4 of that chapter, it tells us that in time Israel went to war with a neighboring nation called Ammon. It says that it came about after a while that the sons of Ammon fought against Israel. And evidently, the Ammonites got the upper hand, as at least in the Gilead region. And that's not too surprising, because if you know the story of Judges, you know that Israel was frequently unfaithful to God in this period, and part of their punishment and God's effort to bring them back, he would give them over into the hands of their enemies. And so that may be what's happening here. And as that begins to happen, and Israel is oppressed by this neighboring nation, they begin to look around for somebody to help them. And who's got an army, you know? Well, and probably embarrassingly, they realize that the person who's most able to help them out, the valiant warrior, is the fellow they ran off. And so Jephthah is the man that they send after to try to get. And so it says in verse 5, it happened when the sons of Ammon fought against Israel that the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, Come and be our chief, that we may fight against the sons of Ammon. And they go and get him and contact him, and Jephthah says, "Hey, why do you want me? I don't remember who I am. I'm the guy that you didn't like. You ran me off, so why are you coming to me when you're in trouble?" And they say, "Well, we really need help now." And so in verse 7, he says, "Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me when you're in trouble?" And they say, "Well, for this reason, we've returned to you, that you may go with us and fight the sons of Ammon and become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." So Jephthah thinks about that. He thought, "Well, so what you're saying is, if I come and help you, then you'll make me chief." They said, "Yes." He said, "Okay, I'll do it. If you'll agree to make me chief, I'll come and help you bail you out of this thing." So he goes and he kind of starts getting an army together to help deliver Israel. And the first thing he does in verse 12 is he tries to do some negotiations. He does, you know, that's prudent. He tries to send letters and messengers to Ammon to try to talk, work out some other means other than war. And I'm not going to read all of that section. It really runs from verse 12 all the way down to verse 28. And basically, you know, they want to, he says, you know, you really don't have any claim to this land. If you'd wanted it, you should have got it 300 years ago. But now it's ours, and we're not going to give it up. And so all of that section, he works on this, some negotiations, but they fail. The negotiations fall apart. And in verse 28 it says, the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. So his speech doesn't work. And now he's going to have to go to war. And so, verse 29, it says, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and he passed through Mizpah and Gilead, and from Mizpah and Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon. So it's probably sort of passing through these territories, collecting reinforcements and building up an army. And it's kind of a risk he's taking. And so before he goes to war, he talks to the Lord and he makes a vow. And he says in verse 30, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So he makes the vow to the Lord. And vows are not too uncommon in the Old Testament. And even in the New Testament, there are vows. Paul, the Apostle Paul, made a vow, and he kept his vow. And a vow was sort of a very solemn promise that you made, and usually it was accompanied with some type of action to secure it. And so in one sense, this seems pretty, you know, perfectly normal according to the law, something that's not too unusual. But you probably also need to know that in an agricultural society, probably Jephthah imagined that when he came back, he'd probably greet some of his animals and livestock before he ever did greet anybody else. Again, I don't think the vow was too unusual. There are different attitudes people can have when they make vows. You can make a vow out of gratitude. If you will give me this victory, I will be so thankful, grateful for what you've done, that I would like to offer you this sacrifice in gratitude for what you've done. That'd be a proper motive. An improper motive would be like, well, if you'll give me victory over this, then I'll give you my cow. Or if you'll give me victory over this enemy, then I'll give you this. Sort of a bargaining chip. Some way to convince God to give you a victory. Kind of make a deal with him. So that would be improper. And I don't think we really know what his motives were in this particular time. But so he makes this vow, and then he heads out. Heads out, and verse 32, he wins the victory. It says, so Jephthah crossed to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. And he probably returns from that battle fairly satisfied and content. God had answered his request, and now he's going to offer his sacrifice and pay his vow to God. And he can also be chief over the Gideonites or Gileadites. So he goes back, but verse 34 says, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Beside her, he had neither son nor daughter. I guess word got back before Jephthah got there. And his daughter's excited. She's happy, rejoicing. Her daddy has won the great battle. So she comes out and she's already celebrating, excited about the victory he's won. And, I don't care how tough he may have been, or how much those worthless fellows had hardened him. I suspect the way he words it in these two verses, it was probably nothing more dear to him in the world than this daughter of his. And so she comes out to meet him. But in verse 35, it says, it came about when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." Well, he's made this vow. Yeah, so his rejoicing sort of turns to a mourning, and his victory is all of a sudden more like a defeat. And what's interesting is his daughter seems to understand that. Look in verse 36. It says, "So she said, 'My father, you've given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon.' Only," she makes one request. She says, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions." This, I think one of the, that's understandable. One of the things that brought value, one of the reasons that women were mostly valued, was because of their ability to produce the children and raise children up in a family in that age. And so she would never do that. In her name, she'd never have that honor attached to her name. And so she wants to remember that. Well, that story has puzzled a lot of people and been a challenge to Bible students over the years. And, it's been argued that, well, you know, he really didn't offer her, you know, as a burnt offering, but he sort of made her, he dedicated her to the Lord as a priestess. And she sort of was never able to get married. She had to live the rest of her life as a virgin. And that's certainly more morally attractive as an explanation. But verse 39 is just hard for me to get by. "And it came about at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made." Did according to the vow that he had made. That's very strong, difficult. You can imagine the trauma in his life. So what do you say about all that? Well, I think the most obvious lesson is that we need to be very careful before we make vows. And that's the obvious lesson that we learned from that. That sort of was something we discussed just a little bit the other week. And the verse that we had read in our scripture reading, if you want to turn there quickly, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, sort of emphasizes the gravity of making vows. It wasn't that he forbid it, but he certainly said you better be very, very careful and hesitant to do that. He says in verse 5, this is Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 5, "It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay it. Let not your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of your messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and many words there is emptiness, rather fear God." So he says, you be very careful. When you make a vow, verse 4 says, "Do not be late in paying it, for he who takes no delight in fools." Pay what you vow. So ask me what Jephthah should have done, I would say, well, you shouldn't have ever made that vow. You know, when we make a commitment and that, you know, and usually we don't think about making vows, probably like they did. Usually it's, when we think vows, we usually attach that to marriage. People make marriage vows. But very powerful lesson about making a vow. How weighty and how significant, how God takes that into account. And they were very aware of that in that day. But it's easy to say what he should have done. But what should he do now? Well, somebody might say, well, he's just in a bind. I mean, either way he goes, he's going to be wrong. He's got to keep his vow. If he doesn't keep his vow, he's sinned by breaking a vow. It's very weighty. Or he's got to sacrifice an innocent person. And it'd be very hard, I think, to say, you know, that did God really want him to do that? And yet, how, you know, do we explain what happened? Well, those are the two choices that Jephthah was probably wrestling between. Breaking his vow or offering as a sacrifice. You know, there was a third solution. There's a third possibility here. He was under obligation to bring about the death of his daughter. So he's caught between this, how to be true to the vow on the one hand and spare the innocent life of a daughter he had no right to take. And I'd say, If you're looking for a hero in the story, it'd probably be the daughter, not Jephthah, because she's willing to accept, you know, what's going to happen to her. But there is a solution. He could have offered himself in place of his daughter. I'm not saying he built an altar and climb on the altar and stab himself. But he could have gone to the Lord and said, I have sinned, and I cannot deliver myself from that sin. He could not deliver himself from making that vow. He had done that. But by committing another sin, by offering his daughter, he felt he was obligated to do that instead. But he could have taken this. He could have said, Lord, would you take my life instead of hers, in place of hers? But that never seemed to occur to him. Well, I want you to think about another case that's a little bit similar to that. Look, if you would, over to the book of Daniel. Look at the book of Daniel, chapter 6. You know Daniel, one of the Israelite sons who was taken into captivity during the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem. By this time in the book of Daniel, his life spans a pretty large era. And by this time, the Babylonians are no longer reigning, but the Persians and the Medes are reigning under Darius. And Daniel is still in a very important position. He's probably an old man. I don't know, 70 maybe? 75? It's kind of hard to know for sure, but he's an older man. I should say he's just a more wise man as I look at these responses I'm getting in the audience from him. But he's somewhere above retirement age, probably. And he's commissioned, one of the three top commissioners that appears in the kingdom. Verse 2 says, let's read verse 6, chapter 6, verse 1 and 2. Seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. So he's in an important position. He's almost comparable to Joseph in Joseph's status in Egypt. But he's a very important man. And he distinguishes himself, verse 3 says, among all the commissioners, because he has an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Maybe he was in line for another promotion. And that created what it does many times, creates jealousy. And there were some others, authorities who didn't like the idea of Daniel having that position, and not to mention that he was a good man, and that probably made them look all the worse. Verse 4 tells us about him. It says the commissioners and satraps began to try to find a way or a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they couldn't find any ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Be a good springboard, wouldn't it, for teaching us about how what kind of character we ought to have in the workplace and such. But he was a good man, and it caused jealousy among these others. And they began to look for possibilities of ways to trap him, to take him out of the position that he's in. So they can't find anything morally questionable, can't find any skeletons in his closet. So they come up with another plan. They look at his religion, and they said, hey, you know, in verse 7, all the commissioners, the kingdom, and the prefects, and the satraps, or verse 5, these men said, we shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him in regard to the law of his God. So they consult together, verse 7 says. And it says the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects, and the satraps, the high officials, and the governors have consulted together so that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. And the king sort of listens to this, and in a moment, I don't know what kind of guy he was, but at least in that moment, he was kind of felt good about that, and he said, I think that's a good idea, let's do it. So they sign it. They fill out the paperwork, create this injunction, and he agrees to it. Look at verse 8. The king established the injunction and signed the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Well, the king didn't make a vow, per se. But in essence, he does. He binds himself by virtue of this contract to do whatever it said, and it can't be changed. So he's obligated, and he's committed himself, and he's binding himself. Well, Daniel learns about the contract, hears about the injunction, but Daniel follows his normal way of life. He goes about praying three times a day to the Lord. Verse 10 tells us that, praying, giving thanks to God, kneeling before the Lord, as he had always done. And, of course, the other governors, they're watching Daniel. They're looking for their opportunity. And sure enough, they catch him doing it. And they come to the king, and they speak to the king. In verse 12, they say, hey, didn't you make an injunction? Didn't you make a law that said anybody who, you know, for 30 days, nobody can bow before anybody other than you, just only you? And he said, yep, that's what I did. He said, guess what? Daniel's violated the law. Daniel's broken the law. And verse 13 says, they said, Daniel, who is one of the exiles of Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you sign, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Well, as soon as it says the king heard that statement, it says he was deeply distressed, verse 14, and he set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue it. How did he do that? I don't know, kind of like politicians do. Try to find a loophole. Try to find a way to get out of the promise that you had made. But it's airtight. He's written into a contract that he can't find any loopholes in it. And can't change. And of course, his governors are nearby to say, nope, can't change it. You signed it. It's signed, sealed, and you can't make any alterations. We know how the story ends. We know, really, in a sense, the rest of the story. And we teach that to show how God spared Daniel because of his faithfulness. And that's a wonderful lesson. That's not what the lesson is this morning, though. Darius went to bed. Darius, the king, he went to bed that night. And in verse 18, it says, he went off to his palace and he spent the night fasting. And no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. When he went to bed, he didn't know what was going to happen. He had made an oath, in a sense, by signing that contract. It was binding, and he didn't know how to honorably get out of it. And yet, at the same time, he knew that he had condemned an innocent man to die. And he didn't sleep very well that night. But there was a way out. There was a way, you know, and I doubt if you ever thought of it, but there was a way that was out that was honorable. He could have said, you know, Daniel's innocent here, and I'm the one that's guilty. And in order to be true to my commitment, then you need to let me be thrown to the den of lions. But he didn't do that. We need to be careful when we sign contracts. And maybe people do that at work sometimes, make agreements. Be careful about that. You put your name on that dotted line. You're obligating yourself to some things. There may be other cases in the Old Testament similar to this. I think this is similar to Jephthah. He kind of puts himself in the same boat that Jephthah had, in a sense. But there's one in the New Testament. Look over there real quick with me. To the book of Mark in chapter 6. This is what was the launching pad for this lesson. I'm not doing very well in my... Mark chapter 6. Herod, the king. You remember him. And John the Baptist. And how John had spent time with Herod preaching and teaching him the truth. And John has ended up in jail for teaching Herod on how illicit his marriage was, and if I understand it correctly, Herod basically put him in jail to keep him safe from his wife, because Herodias wanted to kill him. But he liked John. Well, there was a party, big assembly. Herod had all of his impressive guests there, all of the governors and generals and commanders in the area, and they were all having this great feast. And he has, you know the story, he had his stepdaughter came in and danced before them, and Herod was so pleased with that that in verse 22 of that he speaks to this girl and he says, ask me for whatever you want and I will give it to you. Big mistake. That's what he says. And he doesn't even think about the fact that his who might be waiting in the wings who would take advantage of this. But his daughter, his stepdaughter goes out, talks to Herodias, her mother. She says, tell him I want John the Baptist's plate on his head on a platter. And so he goes back. Again, you hear the rash promise. The rash promise that he makes. And it says down in verse 26, although the king was very sorry, yet because of the oaths and because of his dinner guests, he was unwilling to refuse her. Very sorry. I pointed out in our Bible class a couple of weeks ago, it was the word for agony, a word that was used to describe Jesus in the garden. And so he was upset. I think literally, physically upset because of the decision and the commitment that he had made. And he was under a lot of pressure. He knew he was wrong. He knew John was right. And all his guests were present. Everybody heard him make that vow. And he was either going to have to break his vow. I don't know if he'd been very concerned about committing a sin before God, but he was certainly understood he had made a commitment, and he had a lot of people who were witnesses to that. And on the other hand, he was going to have an innocent man who he feared he was going to have him killed. So I doubt he slept very well either that night. But, you know, he's caught in a bind, and immediately in verse 27 it says he sent an executioner and commanded him to bring back John's head. And he went in and had him beheaded in the prison and brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to his mother. Two solutions or three? One, you break your vow in front of all your guests. I don't know what the consequences have been, but he could have done that. Two, you sacrifice an innocent man, put him to death. That's what he did. Third solution, you say, I was wrong. John is innocent. I should have never said that. To keep my vow, you cut my head off. He didn't think of that, I don't think. Or if he did, he certainly didn't take that option. What these men could have done, Jephthah, Darius, Herod, what these three men could have done, but didn't do, God did for us when he sent his son here. You know, in Romans chapter 6 and verse 23, God too was obligated by his righteousness, by his justice, by his holiness, to respond according to his law when people disobey him. And it says, for the wages of sin is death. He couldn't just ignore that. Couldn't just pass that by. And just as Jephthah loved his daughter, and Darius seemed to love Daniel, and Herod, at the very least, feared John and seemed to like him, how much more do you think did God love us? And yet he's sort of caught. He's sort of caught in the middle. Down between his obligation to keep his law and be true to his righteousness and justice and his mercy and his desire and his love for us. So what will he do? Well, he offered himself in the person of his son for the sacrifice of our sins. He died in our place. But there's something kind of fundamentally wrong with in this comparison, because the daughter of Jephthah was innocent, but Jephthah was guilty. He was a sinner. And Daniel was innocent, but Darius was guilty. He was a sinner. And John is innocent, but Herod is guilty. He's a sinner. So you have the sinner offering himself for an innocent person. But in this case, we have God who is innocent. It's the other way around. He is righteous, and he offers himself for a sinner. Maybe that's why they didn't think about that option. in those other cases. But I want you for the last few minutes for to look at one other case, if you will. Let's look back to the Old Testament. I want to show you one other situation. Look back to the story of David. Look back to the story of David, and you can go back to around, really, it's 2 Samuel chapter 15 through 18, and I'll sort of summarize the story for the sake of time. But David's son, Absalom, goes into exile because he had murdered his half-brother, Amnon, for raping his sister, Tamar. And so he's exiled out of Jerusalem. But the story goes, as time went on, through the intervention of Joab, the commander of David's army, Absalom was brought back to Jerusalem. He was reconciled to his father David. But as it turns out, Absalom wasn't really worth the reconciliation. Because when he comes back to Jerusalem, it wasn't really because he loved his father, but it was because he wanted to maneuver himself in a position to take over the kingdom. And so in chapter 15, you see Absalom beginning to play the role of the king. It says in verse 1, after this, Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. He's acting like a king. And then he begins to promise things to people, everybody who will come to it. He starts, you know, he'd rise early in the morning and stand beside the way of the gate. And as it happened, as any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call him and say, "From what city are you?" And he'd tell him where he's from, and he'd say, verse 3, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." And he would say in verse 4, "Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land, and every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice." So he begins to build support. People begin to listen to that. And you know, he's promising things to people, which, you know, is easy to do when you're not in power, but he's promising things to people. And it says a little bit later, he stole the heart of Israel. Stole their hearts. And they're giving him support, and he mounts a rebellion. And then in chapters 16 through 18, you have the story of this revolt. And he gets an army together, and he makes an attack on the city. And David sort of caught off guard almost, and he has to get his army together, and they just flee. They just barely make it out alive, fleeing the city. And in chapter 16, David's going out, and his head's bowed, and he's going through the valley and leaving the city, and it looks like all is lost. And then when you get down to chapter 18, David gathers his people together. He knows he's got to go back against his son. Absalom's going to have to come after David, and David's got to send an army to stop Absalom. And so in chapter 18, he begins to divide up his forces in three different parts. Chapter 18, verse 1, he numbers the people who are with him, the captains of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And then verse 2, he sends the people out, one third under the command of Joab, another third under Abishai, and another under Zeruiah, Joab's brother. And then another third under the Ittai's, in three different parts. And they begin the, you know, but before they leave, here's the point I wanted to see. Before they get out, he stops and he says, "I have one request." He says to him in verse 4, whatever seems better, you know, he wants to go with them. That's David's nature. He's going to go out to battle. But they say, "No, you need to stay here. Don't go. You stay back in the city." David says, "Well, I have one request." He says in verse 5, he charges Joab and Abishai and Ittai, and he says, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard what the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. And then they go out to battle. You know, David is under obligation here. He's under obligation. He's got to preserve the city. He has an obligation to the people to put down the rebellion against God's people and against the king. But he's caught in a bind. Because on the other side, he doesn't want his son to die. He wants to find a way to spare Absalom. So he says, "Spare Absalom if you can." And then the battles, the forces engage in battle. The armies of Israel begin to prevail over the armies of Absalom. And Absalom is evidently riding through the forest on his donkey. And he gets his head caught in the branches. I don't know how you do that, but he got his head stuck in the trees, and maybe he broke his neck or something. He can't get out. And one of the commanders, one of the people come up, and they see him hanging there, and they go tell Joab and say, Joab, Absalom's over here hanging in the tree. And he says, well, why didn't you kill him? He says, because the king said, don't kill him. And he says, get out of my way. He says, you're slowing me down. So he takes three spears. He really must have loved David, or he really must have hated Absalom. But he threw his three spears through him. He is dead. And he has to send messengers back now with the news. And he sends the first messenger. And the first messenger gets to David. David's, and you know what his first question was? First question wasn't, you know, the guy's real excited. You know, we won the war. David's first question was not, how'd it go? How was the battle? Did we win? Did we overthrow the rebellion? His first question is, what about Absalom? How was Absalom? And the guy didn't know. He said, well, there was some kind of big disturbance going on, but I couldn't see what was going on. And then the next man enters. There was a second messenger came running. And in verse 32, the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite said, let the enemies of my lord, the king, who and all who rise up against you for evil, be as that young man. In other words, he's dead. And David's response is classic. David's response is what we want to read. And that's verse 33. It says the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate, and he wept. And thus he said as he walked, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son. David won, but he lost. He lost his son. And interesting, David thought of it. You know, Jephthah didn't think of it. Darius didn't think of it. And Herod didn't think about doing it. But David thought about it. But do you know that David couldn't have done that anyway, even if he had wanted to? Because it wouldn't have done any good. Because Absalom was a sinner. And really, David couldn't have offered his life in place of Absalom either, because David himself was a sinner. So the bind is there, and there's no resolution. I think about that account with the others that we've read, and think about what God did for us. And it wasn't simply that God just provided a sacrifice in our place, but He provided the only one that He could have offered for us. And that was the pure and holy and sinless sacrifice of Himself in the person of His Son. And that would work. David didn't have that to offer in the place of his son, Absalom. And so when I looked at these cases that we looked at this morning in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, you know, what you see is you see people struggling with the problem of sin and the kind of thing that sin leads to and brings us to. And we see these people caught between these two principles, the idea of, you know, keeping the vow that they made and also, you know, sacrificing someone who is innocent. And it seems that they were without a solution. And that was frustrating and that was helpless. But when I think about that, I can think more about what God did for us. I can see, you know, more of what God did for me. And he said in Romans chapter 5, Paul said it in verse 6, for while we were still helpless, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for the good man someone might dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. Paul talks to us about God, and he's caught between his righteousness and the wrath that should come through that because of our sin and his love for us. Can you see how God resolved the dilemma? How he decided what he would do? The others didn't think about that. David thought about it, but he couldn't do it. But God did it. Shouldn't we be grateful? Shouldn't that move our hearts that somebody made that decision? How often we would not even think about the idea of sacrificing ourselves. But he did. And so whenever you question God's love, whenever you question, does he really love me? Does he know I'm here? Does he care? And this story is really supposed to inform our hearts, and not just inform our hearts, but break our hearts. It causes us to realize that there is somebody that cares about us deeply. And when we have our tendencies to go in the wrong way, it should call us back and show us how much he cares for us. And so therefore, Romans 6 and verse 4 tells us, when we've been buried with him through baptism into death, in order that Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life. When you are walking in a new life and you decide that you're tired of walking in a life of sin and in rebellion against God, the right response is not to say, he can never forgive me, he can never do anything for me, because that's usually me thinking about how whether or not I can forgive somebody else who's done some terrible injustice against me. But he's different, thankfully, than I am. And he would sacrifice himself for us. So if you've never been baptized, that's the motivation. Somebody's died for you and is calling you to die yourself. Put yourself to death. Put the old man to death. Be buried so that God can forgive you for those sins and raise you up and give you a new life. Give you an opportunity to serve him in newness of life. Would you do that? Would you take advantage of the opportunity you have now? Knowing this God and knowing his heart and giving him the opportunity to save you from your sin. At least that's a sin or something.